Okay.
Chairman Cooper, it is now 5:30.
Okay.
Very good.
We did ship somehow. So.
Good evening, everybody. Good to see Mr. Alvord here tonight. You went off on vacation somewhere, I think, last time.
Probably. I don't remember where.
But it was memorable.
And Keith is on vacation now, so.
Okay, well, let's start out with the Pledge of Allegiance first. Director Orzechowski, would you please lead us?
I'll be honored. Please stand, place your right hand over your heart, and say with me, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
With that, we'll go into some announcements. This meeting is being conducted in person at the Summit Circle Engineering Services Section Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the committee using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in or the internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raise hand feature in Zoom. You'll be notified when it's your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it's your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. And for those members of the public that are present, we have public comment cards, and I've received those from you tonight. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I'll introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. The committee will then come to a consensus whether to move this item onto the board for consideration or not. Any PowerPoint shown on tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCB website. All committee members are present. And with that, we can move ahead. Doing these makes you feel like you're a Southwest Airlines stewardess at every meeting in memory. Item 2 is public comment. Ms. Noldemeyer?
Yes, can I just still hear?
Yes.
Yes. I'm getting a little concerned about what I see going on at these meetings and then what goes on with public meetings. And I don't like where this agency is going. And it seems like if every time something comes up, it's more and more leaning ways that, in my mind, are not the proper ways for this supposed water agency to be going. And when I see what's on the agenda here, it's even more disturbing that these things apparently are being done. And the question is why, a lot of times, as to why it's being done and who is benefiting from it. I think that's the main concern I see, especially in some of the things being recommended here about who is it, why are you doing that, and who is really benefiting from it. And it doesn't seem to be the ratepayers are holding it or the ratepayers. So maybe you know something that we don't see at these meetings. Maybe you have your own back and forth or whatever to know the way the vote is going. But when I see who you're getting into with the city, for one, when I see things like that popping up, it concerns me a lot. And I've watched this for many years. I won't say what I used to do, but it had a lot to do with watching things like what I see going on. And you don't put off your responsibilities to another agency in any way, shape, or form. And that's what you're going to do tonight. And when you get into that, things get very iffy and questionable. I'll warn you in advance about that. And all I'm trying to make clear to you that I am very disturbed by what I see going on with this agency and how it's being done. And you might think about it from the mind of the ratepayer that is paying and pushing that their water agency would say separate from any other agency. It proved that they were a separate agency. That's disappearing. And I don't know if I made that very clear to you, but I used to do this profession. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Liz, are there any members of the public online who wish to speak?
Seeing none.
Very good. Thank you. Item 3, this is the quarterly safety presentation by Rebecca.
Hello, how are you doing this evening?
Good evening.
One second, Rebecca. So I can pull it up.
Don't worry, take your time.
Thank you.
On that side. Mm-hmm. We're going to share the other side. One more second. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Hey, there we go. Thank you so much. So good afternoon, board members and E&O committee members. I'm Rebecca Lustig, Environmental Health and Safety Supervisor for Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency. And this is the safety update for the third quarter of the 2022-2023 fiscal year, which covers January 1st to March 31st of 2023. Next slide, please. So just some third quarter routine safety activities. We've continued to have our weekly safety tailgate meetings with our different work groups. Our weekly COVID-19 meetings have continued up until March. Those weekly meetings have been phased out in favor of having as needed meetings and doing a weekly message to the COVID work group of any updates of cases or relevant information. Safety staff has also conducted worksite and facility inspections each month during this quarter, looking at fire extinguishers, fire suppression systems, our life safety equipment, eyewash stations, general housekeeping. We've also been meeting monthly our safety committee meetings with supervisors, and we've now transitioned those into in-person meetings. Pre-construction meetings, as well as other meetings for updates on active ongoing construction projects. New hires to the agency. We've done new hire safety orientations and emergency orientations for evacuation procedures. We get information on their safety equipment needs and PPE and show them the different resources regarding safety that the agency provides. We've also participated in regulatory compliance activities with regards to safety assessments, trainings, hazardous materials and waste, and accompanying inspectors during compliance inspections. And I'm going to review that on our next slide. So for the month of January, we submitted our OSHA 300 log for 2022 that was due this past quarter. So this is our summary of our work-related reportable and recordable injuries for the agency. So we submitted ours when we posted these summaries at each of the job sites in January. Our DART rate was 2.5 and the industry rate for local for water utilities is 2.9. So we were just under the average, but still doing pretty good. We conducted safety trainings on CPR and first aid and at Pine Street. We facilitated an asbestos pipe training at Golden Triangle. We accompanied our Coupa inspector for their first inspection at the Valley Center site. And we facilitated the quadrennial load test for the crane at Rio Vista intake pump station. In February, we conducted additional trainings for CPR and first aid at Golden Triangle. In February, we did audiograms for 79 staff to start tracking their hearing hearing loss that may be work-related. We also did a qualified rigger and signal person class at GT for utility staff. In March, asbestos awareness training at Pine. So this was different than the asbestos pipe training at GT. This was for staff who may encounter asbestos-containing materials in the field but don't actually do any removal or remediation activities. We did confined space rescue training at Golden Triangle. We had a demonstration of a 3-to-1 pulley system assembly at Pine Street, and the purpose of this was for lifting items that are needed at the top of water tanks, and I actually have a photo on that that we'll see in a moment. We had our hazardous materials and hazardous waste inspection at with our Coupa inspector at Earl Schmidt, and safety completed the annual SERS updates for the California Environmental Reporting System at each of our relevant sites. So this is a requirement every year, even if there's no materials or site changes. Our local Coupa, which for us is the LA County Fire Department, requires an update, an annual submittal by the end of each March. Next slide, please. So just a little visuals to go along with what I just mentioned. On the left here, we see the pulley system I just mentioned. So as you can see that by using this pulley system to lift, say, a chlorine bucket or even machinery, it makes it safer for staff in a climbing situation. So they're not having to ascend or descend the ladder while carrying this item with them. They just will climb the ladder, get themselves secure at the top, and then be able to pull it up. On the right, this is the quadrennial load test at Rio Vista. So basically, this proof loading test involves loading the crane equipment and running it through a range of motion tests with that load. And so the bridge crane at Rio Vista is rated for 30,000 pounds. It was proof loaded with about 34,000 pounds. Our inspector passed our test with no remarks or limitations and certified that crane. Next slide, please. So here we see a summary of our safety meetings during the quarter. So something to note here is that, again, March was the last month that we were holding the weekly COVID meetings in favor of the weekly updates and the option to have a meeting as needed. But we've seen an uptick in our meetings in the third quarter because I've been trying to have more project-specific or work group-specific safety meetings with staff and supervisors over this quarter to try and seek input on, say, safety manual policy revisions or to gain insight to concerns that specific work groups have for their employees or for our employees, especially in situations where I might not be aware of it. And safety staff conducted all the safety inspections at all sites during this quarter as well. Next slide, please. So here's the number of reportable and recordable incidents. We did not have any reportable incidents this quarter, but we did have one recordable incident that involved staff experiencing a back strain while performing a task in an awkward position. They didn't miss any days, but were briefly on restricted duty, which made it a recordable incident. And we had tailgate meetings to discuss back ergonomics and obtain back support devices for use by staff if needed. Next slide, please. So there were four vehicle-related incidents that involved agency vehicles, none of which resulted in an injury. Two incidents in January. One was an incident where a member of the public swerved into staff where they were driving. Another incident was during our heavy rains in January, where a car pulled out and stopped suddenly in front of staff, and they were unable to stop in time. And we had a couple of incidents, one in February and one in March, where staff backed into an object. So Staff were assigned safe backing and sharing the road classes in our online training system. We also conducted safety tailgate sessions on tips for safe driving and situational awareness. And not during this quarter, but I will just mention that this past April was National Distracted Driving Awareness Month, which is an initiative from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and National Safety Council. And so we had a really heavy focus on driving in April. Next slide, please. Emergency preparedness activities. Alert media notifications were sent out, the monthly testing, but also safety utilized the alert media system to notify staff of flood watches and warnings and the storm or blizzard warnings that were around during the heavy rains and snow in January and February. Safety also attended the local emergency planning committee Region 1 meeting in February. We also attended the City of Santa Clarita's Emergency Preparedness Group on March 15th, where we met with and discussed safety and emergency preparedness activities for a bunch of groups in the Santa Clarita Valley area. We are still in our planning stages of our STV Waters incident management. We had an initial meeting with all of the incident command members on March 6th, where we identified training needs and the need to reach out to members to identify staff who should also receive incident command training, and discussed a very broad timeline for the group over the next year. So with these efforts, I hope to inform additional trainings and emergency response policies to help SCV become better prepared to respond to an incident, both for staff safety and for service to the community. Emergency radios, both in vehicles and offices, is a project that's ongoing. We're still working on the radio installs with our fleet. And emergency radio antenna, however, at all of the office sites are done. So Summit was actually the last antenna installed, and that was completed in January. And I want to just take a moment to recognize that Santa Clarita Valley Water's building and ground staff did a lot of hard work utilizing their expertise and completing the antenna installations. And Joe, our emergency preparedness and safety coordinator, created and posted a quick reference guide at each of the radios at the work sites. We have emergency supplies, inventory have been received, and safety has been strategically placing these supplies at work sites so that they are available and accessible to staff if and when they are needed during an incident. Next slide, please. And upcoming, we continue to work with our incident management team and preparedness activities. So currently working on a way of identifying key staff to get training, but also we're working on an agency-specific emergency response tabletop exercise. So long-term goal is to develop both discussion-based and when we're ready, operational-based emergency response exercises, both internally, but also coordinating with other local emergency response entities. We're continuing with radio installations in vehicles, working with fleet. We are going to attend the LEPC Region 1 meeting for the second quarter in May. In April, we attended the request for public assistance briefing with Cal OES for information on whether or not we can qualify for any grant opportunities for any repairs that damage that we experienced during any of the winter storms. We are continuing to incorporate the changes of the ammonia RMP. We're currently waiting on some revised diagrams to be completed and just are gradually updating each of our four plans. Continuing again to update our safety manual and injury and illness prevention plan. Safety manual policies are gradually being reviewed in collaboration with key staff. And our injury and illness prevention plan has been updated. And in April, our JPIA representative provided comments on revisions that still need to be incorporated. We have some safety trainings that are scheduled upcoming. In April, we have had their respirator medical evaluations and fit testing. In May, we just completed trenching and excavation. And in June, we have a lockout tagout training planned and also some confined space entry training planned. Next slide, please. And that concludes the safety update for this quarter. So I am happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Good. Thank you, Rebecca. Are there any members of the public questions?
Seeing none.
Seeing none. With that, I'll open it up to directors. President Martin.
Thank you, Chair Cooper. Rebecca, thank you for your presentation. Excellent, as always. Question on the CPR AED training. You're rotating around different locations. Does this mean that the entire staff population gets this training over the course of a year, or who gets the training?
So at minimum, there's certain key staff that need to have the training, and then there's the safety monitors at each of the work sites for evacuation. We'll get the training, and anybody, it's open to anybody who wants to sign up for it, and anybody that gets certified, I believe it's good for 2 years. Any specifics on the training? I do have Joe Diaz, who's actually the one performing the training because he's a certified trainer, that can answer those questions as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Director Orzechowski.
Regarding AEDs, do we have those in every staff-occupied building?
Yes, we do.
And do we? How often do we check the batteries and charge?
The batteries and the charge? Oh, actually, Joe can answer that question. I know we do have a company that comes by and does the checks monthly, but I don't know if they check the batteries each month.
Oh, okay.
Yes, good evening. Aaron and I, when we do our life safety checks monthly, those are inspected by us each month. The AEDs actually are performing a self-check each day. So at 6 a.m., it's actually pre-populated by the manufacturer. It does a self-check each morning. And if there's any issues with either the components or the batteries, it actually will go into alarm just like a smoke detector. The batteries are good for 4 years, and the pads themselves are good for 2 years. So we've got about 2 more years until the batteries will need to be replaced agency-wide. But yes, we check them monthly. We're actually part of the LA County PAD system, so the public administrators for defibrillators. We have them all registered to LA County Emergency Services, and I'm the primary contact for the agency. We used to have a contract with Cintas in the past, and due to our evolvement of our safety department, we're able to eliminate that added expense, and so we're able to perform these inspections. I'm actually a certified EMT through LA County as well, so it does provide some added benefit.
Okay, and a follow-up question. What's the goal for each agency staff to be trained on how to operate? I mean, they're very easy to operate. They even give you instructions on the actual instrument, but is that the goal, 100% training for all staff?
That would be a great goal, but again, it'd have to be the employee themselves who would want to volunteer to perform that as we evolve, but primarily the field staff, because they're out in the field, and emergency safety monitors like Rebecca mentioned, since they would be ideal key staff to assist with the evacuations, but all the other staff would be a voluntary.
What about the public counter? Is that a requirement for training?
The public counter, so we have our emergency safety monitors at the Rockefeller location who are primary staff and who are trained as well.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Diaz. One question for you, Ms. Lessing. Have you had a chance to visit every SCV Water facility that's staffed by SCV Water?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I've been to a bunch of the ones that aren't usually staffed as well. So I am gradually making my way through everything. But I've been to all of the sites that that the safety department actually inspects, and then plus some additional sites that we don't perform routine inspections on, but they our staff will visit, say, some of the tank sites.
Okay. And I know this sounds like a broken record, but you know, thank you again for the rigging training. That's crucial, very important. So thank you for that. Let's open me back to you, Chair.
Thank you. Director Peterson, anything?
Nothing. Sounds good.
Anyway, Rebecca, one question I had is, a couple of the vehicle accidents were backup accidents, and we've installed cameras, backup cameras on all of the vehicles now. Are they functioning or?
They are functioning. They do actually sometimes, the reports that I get with that involved? That's one of the first questions asked. And there have been some reports of it being cloudy or maybe being a little glitchy and going in and out. So the cameras do help for sure, but we always want to remind everybody that even if their camera isn't working, that they still need to have that situational awareness as they're backing up, because we, even without a camera, we shouldn't be running into things.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item four, presentation on laboratory regulations and quality assurance. Jeff.
All right. My name is Jeff Kulawine. I'm the Water Quality Laboratory Manager. Just a couple of preliminary remarks. Agency has a small laboratory. There's five total staff, including myself. Another thought is that a water agency does not automatically allow to do water testing. We're certified by the state of California, so that's what I'll be going over. So next slide. I'll be reviewing some basics on laboratory regulations. The certification that we hold is from an organization called the Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program. We call it ELAP. They are part of the State Water Resources Control Board under the Division of Drinking Water. And then also review quality systems. There have been new laboratory regulations implemented, which is, I think, one reason I'm presenting this topic. The new quality systems are a standard, again, lots of acronyms. We call it TNI, which is the NELAC Institute. And NELAC stands for the National Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Conference, which is an organization that's been around over 20 years. And basically, they've wanted to have a standard set of quality control systems nationwide, especially for labs that work across many states. So you can imagine if you're a lab that have labs in several different states, meeting all the different state requirements is very burdensome. TNI is a standardization technique so that every lab that meets TNI requirements will meet the state requirements any place they go. So I'll be going into all these topics in more detail. Next slide. So I thought I would start with, if you were starting a lab, where do you begin, especially with the regulations? So at the federal level, the rules regarding lab and testing are in the Code of Federal Regulations, CFR Title 40, Part 141, which is part of the Environmental Protection Agency regulations. Under National Primary Drinking Water Regs, Subpart C, Monitoring and Analytical Requirements. Now, I actually rarely reference this because all of these regulations are incorporated into the California Health and Safety Code, but much of it originates from the federal level. Because, of course, California is a primacy state for drinking water regulations. That means they adopt the EPA regulations and then add to them typically, but they have to have all the EPA regulations. And really the one reference point that I would go to this next slide, there are tables in the regulations like this. This is just one page. Every test that a lab does, we have to use methods that are authorized by EPA. So we just can't decide to do a test any particular way. So what this table shows is if you pick an analyte, we'll pick number 21, pH is very simple. You can see the columns list different sources of methods. There's EPA methods, there's ASTM methods, and then there's standard methods. And so if you're going to do pH in a certified lab, you have to use one of these methods. And now I'll talk more about these methods. So next slide. A very common and much used book, which is, as Ken said, much larger than it was even a few years ago. But this is the book that we constantly reference. This is called Standard Methods for the Examination of Wastewaters, of Water and Wastewaters. And I put the different chapters, but all of these list different techniques for doing different tests. And in fact, this part 9,000 is where we get all of our microbiological tests are from standard methods. We use other methods from different sections, typically the water physical parameters, simple things like pH, conductivity. We use standard methods. And so that's one source of a method. And again, when a lab does a method, you have to follow the requirements of this standard method. So next slide. Then the EPA over the past several decades has written many different methods too. And they some methods are common that you may have the same test in standard methods and EPA. You can choose which one you want. You just have to follow the requirements of whichever one you choose. The ones that are listed here are the ones our lab uses for these different tests. So there are 8 of them that we use. Usually when it has like a decimal 7, like EPA 200.7, the 0.7 is the 7th revision. EPA hasn't really kept up with revisions on these older methods. For example, 200.7 is over 30 years old, whereas the PFAS methods are sometimes 2 and 3 years old. So they focused on new things, and the older methods, though, are still used by labs. These titles here are just my summaries. So like anions by IC, those are the common anions we analyze for: chloride, bromide, fluoride, sulfate. But next slide, this is the actual title of a method. This is Bi-33. This is actually the newest method that we are doing. It's the determination of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances in drinking water by isotope dilution, anion exchange, solid phase extraction, and liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry. I'll say that 3 times in a row. So that's what I've been working on the last 6 months. And that's why I put that one up there. So next slide. So going back again to how ELAP functions under the Division of Drinking Water, ELAP was established in 1989. And so any environmental lab in California that produces data for a California regulatory agency must be certified by ELAP. And ELAP calls that any data for compliance with California Health and Safety or Water Code. Of course, we're just concerned about drinking water, but they also certify labs to test wastewater, food for pesticide residue, shellfish testing, and hazardous waste. I put there just the steps for accreditation. Obviously, we've been accredited for a long time. The renewal process is actually similar to what's there. So you initially apply to ELAP if you want to become an accredited lab. There's quality system requirements that I'll be going over in detail in a bit. You have to have acceptable proficiency testing results, or PT samples. What a proficiency testing sample is, we're required on an annual basis for every test that we perform. We purchase these PT samples from a company. And again, I'll use something simple like pH. So they send us a bottle, a sample that we test for pH. Obviously, we don't know the answer. We submit the results to this company, and then after a period of time, they send us a report and say for pH, there's an acceptable range that you have to get the right answer. So it's a test. And again, we have to do that for every test. And ELAP has very strict requirements on that. If you can't pass that test, then you can't do that analysis. So we do those on an annual basis. Another part of accreditation is an on-site assessment, an OSA, or usually we just call it an audit. And I'll be going into some detail about that has changed too over the years. And then you have to pay fees to ELAP. So again, it's a state agency. Sometimes I call ELAP the DMV for labs. They don't always like being called that. But that's just my term. Next slide. These are the basic staffing requirements in the ELAP regulations. It's really for 2 positions, for the laboratory director and then for the principal analyst, they call it. And again, the terms lab director, I think the regs actually call it the technical manager. And then, so the lab director has to have a bachelor's degree in one of those fields. It's usually chemistry, biochemistry, biology, but there's several there that are acceptable. The lab director must also have at least 3 years experience in a laboratory. The principal analyst requirements are for staff operating what they call sophisticated instruments, and I'll go over that. And this will come up when we talk about the TNI regulations. They do allow the technical director to serve as the quality manager, even though that's not preferred. But again, for small labs, which we would be considered a small lab, the technical director can serve as the quality manager. So I hold both of those titles in our lab. Next slide. These are what, and I think there's actually more on the list, but these are what ELAP define as sophisticated instrumentation. And I put on there the red are how many our lab has. So we have one GCMS, we have three ICs, one ICP, one ICP-MS, and one LCMS. And so where that comes into play, next slide, getting down to, again, the audit or the on-site assessment requirement. Up until recently, ELAP performed all lab audits. But under the new regulations, if you have any of the sophisticated instruments, you use what's called a third-party assessment company. These are outside companies, outside of ELAP, outside of labs, obviously, that you hire to perform the audit. There are some very small labs that maybe do one or two microbiology tests that ELAP staff will audit. But most labs now in California have to hire a third-party assessor. And there are three companies right now that ELAP has approved for doing these assessments. We use a company called International Accreditation Services. Again, just for our lab, it's a two-year renewal cycle, and our cycle ends September 30th. So very soon, actually due by June 30th, I will be applying for our renewal. It's just a paperwork process. I've already mentioned the PT samples are done annually. Our current fee, the fee is based on how many tests you do, how many different types of tests. It's currently $8,850 a year. And then every test is on what we call our certificate. Next slide. That's what it looks like. This is actually the printout version of it. So all our tests are listed on our certification. So it lists field of accreditation, or basically organized groups of tests like microbiology of drinking water, inorganic chemistry. And then it lists each test and what method that we're certified to use. And when we do our PT samples, and we use that method. And again, we can't do any test that's not on the list. So it's a very important document, actually, for us. Next slide. So now we'll kind of go change gears and start talking about quality systems. This list here is just a general list of what a quality system would contain, not necessarily specific just to labs, actually, except maybe the data management. The idea of this is that any organization needs a quality system. And so these items here are all part of the quality system for our lab. Next slide. So the history on quality systems, again, this has been an evolving topic over the decades as labs have developed. And as far as I know, there could be some other items, but the first manual I'm aware of, EPA published in 1990, it was called the Manual for the Certification of Labs Analyzing Drinking Water, which included criteria, procedures, and quality assurance. And so that was really the first document that kind of spelled out what kind of quality systems you needed in a lab. ELAP had a more or less a checklist. They called it the microbiology checklist for laboratory on-site inspection, which was very specific for the microbiology methods. And actually, when you look at the history, that sort of makes sense because ELAP, from its when it was founded, was in the Department of Public Health. And so its focus was very much on the microbiology testing and methods. And again, over the years, when I've experienced ELAP audits, they spent most of their time on the microbiology, making sure you're doing those correctly. And so some of the changes that have now happened with ELAP started when in 2014, it was moved from Department of Public Health to the State Water Resources Control Board. And one thing that happened after they moved was there was an expert panel review of ELAP in 2015 to 17. And they started that process because the organization ELAP was not performing well. And they had an expert panel reviewed ELAP itself on how it conducted its business and made a lot of recommendations. And one of the big recommendations from this review panel was that ELAP then instituted a new quality system requirement. They had an old system that they were using, and then they instituted the TNI system in 2021 and basically gave labs a three-year period to comply, required to meet those requirements by January 1st, 2024. So you may ask, well, what is TNI 2016? That's this document here. There's several sections to it. The first one is the general requirements or management technical requirements. Next slide. Again, very detailed on how you set up your quality system. And I just, again, there's too much detail for me to go over all of this, but you see that list of items under management requirements. All of those items then are referenced in our quality assurance manual. Next slide. So we had to write a quality assurance manual that meets some TNI requirements. That's this document here. And next slide. It has, I didn't show all of it. There's 28 sections, and those sections all are basically right from the TNI requirements because the QA manual has to meet the TNI requirements. And you can see it covers lots of parts of the lab, not really related to testing so much, but you have to define your organization, your management of your lab, your document control, review of contracts, subcontracting. Now I'm reading that's what's not up there. Your purchasing of supplies, service to your client, how you handle complaints, control of non-conforming work, improvement, corrective actions, preventative action, control of records, audits, management reviews. I'll stop because you're probably thinking this is too much. There's 28 sections like that. Next slide. Then there's another part of the TNI standard, which then is the quality systems for chemical testing. So now we're starting to get into, you know, more specifics on the actual methods and testing, whereas the QA manual is more the policy manual. Then you start getting down with your different how you do your testing. So next slide. And again, this is what the TNI requirements are for chemical testing. And those then are reflected in our procedures. Next slide. And so now I'll talk specifically about what has occurred in our lab. The quality assurance manual, this document here, was implemented January 1st of 2022. There are also, I call them administrative standard operating procedures, SOPs. These, again, more general SOPs for the lab. The first one is a standard operating procedure on how to write standard operating procedures, SOP for SOPs. Another item that TNI emphasized and ELAP emphasized. In fact, it was implemented before the T&I requirement. It's called ethics training. And this arose from usually commercial labs that had fraudulent activities. And so laboratories are required to do annual ethics training that I do with my staff. All lab staff sign a document saying they will not engage in any fraudulent activities. And I always say to them, what that means is no lying, cheating, making up stuff. You know, you do your tests, you record it accurately. You don't make up stuff. You don't make up numbers. Most of the fraud that has happened has been with commercial labs where somebody paid somebody to put out false results for whatever reason. But that's actually a very important part of our annual training. Now, I think this is probably the most important of what we do. We have 15 different test methods and standard operating procedures, and that's in this binder. So this now starts getting into the specifics of how staff do different tests. So if I pick a, like this particular SOP tells you how to do alkalinity, pH, and conductivity. So this is what the staff references. This stays in the lab. So if they're doing a test and they want to look up how to make up a reagent or something, all of that information is in this SOP binder. There's a T&I format. Every SOP has to have all aspects of the T&I requirement. There's 20 different sections. And again, the sections are things like, you know, summary of the method, safety issues, equipment required, agents required, sample collection, preservation, the quality control, initial demonstration of performance, limited detection, calibration, procedure, the actual procedure, calculations, method performance review. So again, everything that you need to know to do the test is in this SOP. There's also a
Jeff, sorry to interrupt. If we pass that, I do have to post the entire thing online.
Oh, sure.
So I know that you guys know that. So I will need a PDF of it.
Okay.
Yes. Anything that's passed out has to get posted online.
So be it.
Okay. These are all separate PDFs. So another thing we had to do, now some of these we had different levels of, but just to show you what we did to implement all the T&I requirements. All lab forms and templates had to have a unique identification. So we had to come up with a naming and numbering system for everything. Of course, all lab instruments and support need to have an ID. All reagents have to have an identification. All lab solutions have to have identification. Next slide. All purchase calibration standards, any calibration dilutions, all support documents. Another important concept that really is part of T&I is what's called traceability. And the idea is that everything we use in a test has to be traceable to some reference point. So if we're making a reagent up, we say we purchase a chemical, we have to have a certificate of analysis from the manufacturer. Then if we make a solution, then we have to trace reagent to the solution, and we give that an ID number. And then when we use that solution in a particular test on the data, we have to record that identification so that if someone's looking at data, they can trace everything back to a source. And so that's why most of this, you require unique identifications on almost everything in the lab. And everything, thermometers, pipetters, and it all has to be traceable back to the data. Our final report, it has to meet a format that's T&I compliant. We implemented an internal audit system that I perform on a monthly basis. I pick a method or another area of the lab, and I document an internal audit. We do what's called an annual management review, which is I review the year for things like, you know, does the lab have enough resources, including staffing, budgeting, instrumentation to do what work we do? Mike reviews that and signs off on it. We have a corrective action and complaint system. So anything that either a complaint from our customer singular, since our only customer is really ourselves. We document how to do that. Next slide. We also have to have documentation of demonstration and capability for all analysts and tests, limited quantitation for all analysis annually. We validate all spreadsheet calculations. We back up all instrument electronic data. Next slide. And I'm running out of time. So just a last little bit of history here. When we had our last full lab audit by ELAP in 2015, which they're supposed to be doing these every 2 years, but there it is. It was a one-page report with no deficiencies found. So we had our on-site assessment conducted by IAS auditors February 15th and 16th. It was a full lab audit to TNI 2016 standards, including a review of EPA 533, which was a method we wanted to add to our certification. Their assessment report was 89 pages long. That doesn't mean it's all bad. A lot of it was reviewing what they had reviewed. And they found 25 deficiencies. I'll go over those too. But of those 25, 9 were documentation issues, traceability. Next slide. And just some of the timing, they generally have 30 days between each step. We received the audit report March 7th. I sent a corrective action back of what we did in response to this deficiency by March 27th. They accepted our corrective actions on April 12th. And then we submitted our amendment application to ELAP for EPA Method 533 on April 13th, and then we received our new certification April 19th. Now, what's significant about that is 2 years ago in 2021, when we added EPA Method 537, which is the other PFAS method, it took 4 or 5 months to receive our certification after submitting our application. This time it took 6 days. So ELAP has obviously been getting more efficient. And I mentioned already, our renewal application is due June 30th. A big part of that is we have to have our full lab audit. Well, it's finished. So I just have to basically submit the paperwork. And then beginning September 30th, we will be fully TNI compliant lab. And we will meet the requirement before the January 1st requirement. We also document a lot of different things, different ways. We still use books like this, log books. We also tend to use Excel spreadsheet lists. We also, using our LIMS software, LIMS's Laboratory Information Management System software, produces reports also. So we have printouts like of our calibration standards. And again, the things I always tell my staff with TNI are documentation, because if you don't write it down, it never happened in a lab context. So, for example, I say, if you were being asked about some data from a year ago, and they say, well, what standard did you use? Well, if you didn't write it down, you'll not remember. So everything we do has to be written down. Documentation, and then traceability, which I've talked about. Those are two of the big things of TNI. Another thought on TNI is that it's very much about having good records, good documentation. However, it does not tell you how to do the tests. That's up to the lab. You just have to meet their different requirements, but it doesn't tell you how to work the instruments, how to do the tests. So there's still a lot of knowledge you need to have outside of TNI. TNI is the quality system. It's not the actual lab work. Any questions? I said I went fast.
Before we get into questions, we'll first ask if there are any members of the public out there.
Seeing none.
Very good. Questions, Gordon? Greg Gorzowski.
Great presentation.
love to see the notebook. Okay, so your staff uses the notebook and a software to note down everything they do in the lab, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to me what's the difference between the notebook and the software they use to record their step-by-step processes?
And again, this is where T&I really doesn't tell you you have to be a certain way. So it's some of it's our choice.
Yeah.
So for example, this notebook happens to be just a log of reagent preparation.
Okay.
So if they're going to make up a solution, they record, you know, how much of a standard reagent they weighed out, its final volume, its concentration, and it's given a unique identification. We could actually probably convert this to a software process, but just for now, we're using this. Some of our simpler tests, like say color or turbidity, where you look at a reading on an instrument and record a value, we produce those form from our LIMS software. And so it actually, we use it to print out the form and then they fill in the results. And then we put the results back into LIMS for reporting. Most of our instrumentation data is all electronic. So if we run a test and we have data for like say chloride and nitrate, we review that data. We prepare what we call a quality control summary sheet. Every method we do has multiple quality control requirements, calibration, spikes, and then we record all that QC summary, but the actual numbers for the sample then are electronically transferred into LIMS. So there's no hand transfer of those numbers. And then what I typically do is I'll review the numbers from the instrument software to LIMS. And what LIMS does is we prove it. And then when all the values for a particular sample are completed, we can produce the final report. So again, most of it is electronic in terms of the volume of testing. Things like microbiology, again, where you observe something, then that's a written record. And of course, all those records are kept for more than 10 years.
So what was my next question? What is the retention policy?
Yeah, that's
10 years?
10 years, yeah. For labs, it's 5 years. But for water agency, it's 10 years. So we keep everything for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And as far as our equipment, like ICP-MS, what brand do you use?
Instrument manufacturer. For the ICP, ICP-MS are both PerkinElmer.
Okay. Any particular, are we leaning more towards a particular brand or
buy an instrument, we get quotes from multiple vendors. Obviously, we lean toward, of course, the most cost-effective. Again, a lot of it is PerkinElmer was one of the leaders in ICP, ICP-MS. Actually, for the PFAS instrument, which is our largest purchase, we purchased a SCIEX instrument. And a lot of that was actually their price was the best, but they also, I had a previous coworker who said that's the company to use. And actually, that instrument has been wonderful, actually. We do PFAS runs with hundreds of quality control measurements, and they'll all be acceptable.
Excellent. And then a follow-up question on that. So it's you and you have five other staff in the laboratory. Four other staff. And how many of them are trained on, let's say, PanGEM-MS or ICP-MS? All of them?
Right now, we used to rotate somewhat, so they're all familiar with most of the instruments, partly just different skill levels, and then also partly because of T&I requirements. You have to document each person's training, so specifically that more and more we go to each one's assigned a group of tests. So typically we have one that does all the microbiology, one does ion chromatography, One does the metals and one does the PFAS testing. There's some cross training. I'm kind of a backup rarely, but like if someone's on vacation, you know, something has to be done. They all can do the microbiology because again, that's has to be done daily.
Okay.
So.
And since 2018, have you retained the same staff? What's the attrition rate in your lab?
Oh, three of them have been with the agency more than 20 years, and two of them, including myself, have been more than 12 years.
Thank you.
Questions? Not much questions. Well, a couple of questions, but very impressive presentation. I'm just glad you're doing it. The small group you have in the lab, actually in the lab, does the O&M staff bring in samples to be tested, or what's the connection between lab and the sample taking?
Actually, that's where there was a change. You know, when it was the old Castaic Lake Water Agency, one of my staff did field sampling, probably 2/3 of her time. As we transitioned with the new agency and departments kind of reconfigured, so now there's a water quality department under Ryan Bai, and his staff collect all the samples. So that was one way we didn't have to hire additional staff, because basically one of my staff converted from a field to a full-time lab. But no, we don't do any sampling. The lab doesn't. So all the samples are brought in to us daily.
Well, again, thank you for the presentation. It would be great if the full board could hear this at some point in time. I know you've got other better things to do. But I mean, it's pretty eye-opening for me. I'm not a chemist, so water quality testing is not my thing. But I appreciate what you and your team do.
As an old chemist, this is music to my ears right now. But do you foresee any big purchase items in the next year or two?
No, and Mike and I have talked about this because, of course, PFAS was the newest, biggest test.
Yeah.
And the instrument we have has a lot of capacity, so I don't see us needing like a second instrument. Over the next few years, I think we're projecting 15 groundwater treatment plants of various kinds. Of course, that means more testing, more sampling. Right now, the staff can handle the workload, but there's going to come a tipping point where we'll need more staff. One idea is to separate the quality assurance from myself. And again, T&I is written because they prefer to have a technical manager separate from a quality manager. Again, a typical organizational concept where the person producing the work, you don't want them thinking, wow, we got to get these results out. But it's not quite good enough yet. Yeah. So I have to wrestle with that. But if you have a second person saying, no, you need to do this, you know, before you report those results type of thing.
And sorry, one last question, Chair. Space. Do you have enough space? Would you anticipate needing more space, more hoods?
We're pretty good with space. There is talk of some remodeling of the lab because it was built in 1995.
Yeah, can I add Jim Cooper? As Jeff was saying, staffing is going to be an issue at some point. But you all just approved a QA/QC supervisor for, I think, not this coming fiscal year, the following one. So we're looking at that. Jeff, unfortunately for him, he's not allowed to retire.
You have to go through a process.
Yeah. It's about 20 years to take. But we have, he and I have looked at and talked about potential some remodel. It's nothing critical, but as Jess said, you know, it's getting on 20 years old. And cabinets are a little old, and some of the shelving, the counters tops are a little old. So we've been looking at that, and we'll probably start budgeting for some, you know, just some facelift and a little improvement in some areas over the next 5 years.
Okay. And you did say that you are rotating your people through different methods, or you stopped doing that?
We don't rotate. Like I said, most of them are cross-trained. And again, we have, you know, people on vacation. We also have to cover weekends, so they rotate covering the weekend work. So several of them have been cross-trained.
If you do decide to show this to the board, I would highly recommend images and pictures. Not necessary for us here, but like it would be beneficial to do to the board.
Oh, yeah. Because when I do talks on water quality in lab, I usually include pictures of the instruments in the lab. Yeah.
I think we were just more interested in methods, the recent audit, and how you conduct business.
That's the rule.
Okay, thank you.
I guess my question was part of my question about space that's been answered. But as far as TNI, do they get into the discussion about space, how you use your space, and how it's done for testing?
Actually, they do even staffing. I mean, if the auditor came in and felt that the space wasn't suitable, and usually what that would involve was the, say, you're trying to do microbiology in a very dusty, dirty environment. Yeah. They could cite you for that, saying you can't be doing that. Or if they felt like your staffing was just overwhelmed, I mean, you know, it'd have to be something pretty dramatic where the auditor would feel like you need to do something. But that's part of the quality assurance manual and even the annual management review. One of the specific questions is, does the lab have all the resources, you know, equipment, space, people to do the work that it's supposed to be doing?
It's a whole new world again with ELAB.
Yeah, it is. It's very different than a few years ago.
Chair, one more question. So page 34 of our packet, 24 of your presentation, 25 deficiencies found, 9 documentation issues, 3 SOP changes, and 13 lab procedures. What was wrong with the lab procedures?
Right, because I was trying to distinguish the different, you know, types of deficiencies. So here's one example. I'll give you 2 examples. And again, when I first saw the report, I'm like, wow, 25 items. They are actually very, what would be the right word? Nitpicky, detailed. So here was one deficiency. We have a large incubator for our microbiology analysis. In standard methods, you have to have 2 thermometers in it and record the temperature twice a day, which we do. Standard method says those thermometers will be on the bottom and top shelf. Our incubator has 3 shelves. Our thermometer was on the middle shelf, probably since 1995. That's a deficiency. The middle thermometer has to be on the top shelf. And so that was a lab procedure. Another one was we have an autoclave, which we use to sterilize media. It has a mechanical timer. Well, we have to verify that timer against a digital clock quarterly, which we do. The deficiency was we were not verifying the digital timer against an NIST verified time source. That was another deficiency. Another procedure was I have a form for a corrective action process. So if we find something, there's a problem, we analyze it, we find a solution. The deficiency was my solution, the corrective actions I'd done had 1 solution. TNI requires me to identify multiple solutions and then pick the best answer. Again, okay. Extremely detailed. Oh, and then the other one that was my favorite, and one of my SOPs, the model number of the instrument, I had the number flipped. Instead of 5975, it was 5795. And so he wrote that up as a deficiency. I had the model number incorrect in the SOP.
That is a very detailed audit.
They are.
And do we have more than one autoclave in the laboratory?
We have one, but we have there's actually a spare one at the Earl Schmidt. Earl Schmidt has an older lab that the operators use, but there's an identical autoclave there. That's my backup.
Okay. That's a problem.
And just a quick one for you, Jeff. Uh-huh. Are we prepared when microplastics comes around? Is there a procedure now to test for microplastics yet?
That's a very new topic. They have just published a method because there was no standard method for doing it. So there's activity on it. We haven't looked into that method because it's very new. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the state has had a few labs develop the method and they're going to start doing some monitoring. But it is a topic that is coming up.
It'll be coming to us
in
the next couple of years.
Kind of like PFAS. Hopefully not like PFAS.
Not like PFAS. Well, thank you very much. That was excellent. I appreciate my effort you put into this.
And if you want me to present it to the full board, I can do that.
We'll work at something and maybe they can put together something a little bit shorter and
visual.
Yeah,
more visual.
Right.
Directors do well with visual.
Yeah. More about the lab, not the specific topics.
Very good. Thank you, Jeff.
All right, sure.
Item 5 is Orlando Marinas going to be on. And this is to recommend approval adopting a resolution to approve the initial study mitigated negative debt and under CEQA and a purchase order for Hayes and Sawyer for final engineering services for the S wells PFAS and disinfection. So.
Thank you, Director Cooper. Good evening, everyone. Jeff, I've got some big shoes to fill after your presentation, so I'll try my best. My name is Orlando Moreno. I'm a senior engineer and the project lead on the S-Wells PFAS treatment project. I also have Annalise Torres, senior environmental planner at Rincon Consultants, and Rick Bergutz, our principal planner here at the agency's Water Resources Department, who will be helping me answer any questions during the Q&A session. So Liz, if you don't mind going to the next slide, please. Okay, the agency operates three groundwater wells called the S6, S7, and S8, wells shown here in these blue circles. These wells are located just north of the Santa Clara River between McBean Parkway and just south of Newhall Ranch Road in the Bridgeport community. Each well can produce up to a permitted capacity of 2,000 gallons per minute. The three wells were taken offline due to PFAS detection that exceeded the state's response level. S6 has been inactive since December of 2019. 7 and 8 have been offline since approximately March of 2020. They've been offline since, and we're hoping to bring those wells back in service here. Next slide, please. Staff explored several potential sites for a future treatment facility. We looked at several properties shown on this slide. Some of these sites were in environmentally sensitive areas within the river floodplain. Other locations are just way too small to fit the size of the facility we needed. And then locations like 3, 4, and 5 here were just way too close to private residences. So, these locations were just not feasible. Next slide, please. So we did find a good location. We were proposing to locate the facility in an undeveloped area just east of the existing wells between the Bridgeport Park and the bike trail that runs along the north side of the Santa Clara River. The location you can see here in this yellow shape on the exhibit. This property is owned by the city of Santa Clarita, and the agency intends to lease the property through a long-term lease agreement with the city. The location was chosen due to its proximity to the S-wells and nearby pipeline infrastructure. The property is isolated from surrounding residential areas. The closest dwelling unit is about 400 feet away from the site. The site is surrounded by large mature trees that naturally screen the property. It's outside of the 100-year floodplain and is outside of any environmentally sensitive areas. Next slide. All right, we're zooming into the proposed treatment facility layout. This site plan was developed during preliminary design by Michael Baker, international consultant. The raw groundwater from the S wells would enter on the left side or the west side, be pre-treated with pre-filters. You can see those in blue here. And then the water would enter a series of up to 8 above ground ion exchange vessels. Those are shown here in this green color. The facility would include a single-story enclosed chemical building that will house our hypochlorite generation system and liquid ammonium sulfate system. You can see that in this brownish-orange color here on the left corner. The treated and disinfected water would then be directed to the north and connect to our existing Valencia distribution system. We also anticipate a new well, what we currently call the S9 well, till Mike changes the name, but that may be constructed at this facility in the future. You see that location here in yellow. That new well will be included as part of, will not be included as part of this project. However, the site will be designed to accommodate and provide provisions for that future well, if and when it is constructed. We do expect that this new well will contain PFAS, which will be treated at this facility. Next slide. We have several offsite improvements that need to be done for this project. We'll need some new water pipeline work and storm rain pipelines across the park, and then next to the river bike trail. You can see those in this red color. Hardscape and landscaping will be replaced as needed in these areas. And then there's also a possibility of some minor street improvement work, as we may have to redo some of the roundabouts for large delivery trucks. And so that's still going to be further evaluated during our final design. Next slide. So staff retained MIG Incorporated, a landscape architecture and community engagement consulting firm. They assisted us in conducting 2 public engagement meetings. The first meeting was held at Bridgeport Elementary School on August 31st of last year. We had approximately 12 members of the community attend in person. And then we followed up with a second meeting, which was provided virtually through Zoom, where we had 2 community members. During these meetings, we introduced the project, provided an open forum for the community to comment on the project, and also express their concerns and share some ideas. We did receive really good feedback from the community members, and we intend to use that input as we complete our final design on the project. Next slide. So this is an example of a landscape plan that was prepared to incorporate some of those comments we received. We had several requests for adequate landscape screening around the facility. Obviously, aesthetics is really important in this part of our community. Some preferred landscaping that blended in with the surrounding neighborhood. You know, they wanted to use a similar boxwood plant palette that is green year long, while others wanted to use more native tolerant planting that kind of represents the river's riparian vegetation. So a solution was proposed to include a combination of the two, where more green planting would be provided on the north side that kind of blends in with that Bridgeport community, while some native landscaping could be provided on the south side to kind of blend in with the river. Next slide. Another concern we heard from the community was the need for tall perimeter walls to properly screen these tall ion exchange vessels along the south side of the facility. So to address this, the design proposed that the vessels be set on a depressed slab to lower the profile of the vessel, which reduces the overall height of the perimeter wall there. So you can kind of see in this exhibit, the view sheds from the street the walls get reduced by lowering the profile of that vessel there. Next slide. This is a rendering of what the facility could look like. You can see kind of the screening elements here. We've got some decorative paneling, some landscaping, and this is if you were standing across the street looking towards the facility there from the park. Next slide. Okay, so moving on to CEQA, staff retained Rincon Consultants, an environmental consulting firm that assisted us in preparing the initial study, mitigated negative declaration and mitigation monitoring and reporting program, what we call MMRP. All these documents were prepared in accordance with CEQA requirements and guidelines. A notice of intent and draft MND were advertised and released for public review from November 18th through December 9th of last year. Comments were received from three agencies, Caltrans, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the State Water Resources Control Board. A formal response was provided to those agencies and is included in the final MND. Next slide. So the final MND indicates that the project may potentially impact several environmental resources listed here in the first column of this table. And it concludes that these impacts can be avoided or reduced to a level of insignificance if implementation of several mitigation measures are included or followed as outlined in the final MMRP. A list of those mitigation measures are provided in this table. I would point out that the mitigation measures are pretty common for a project of this complexity, though BIO3 is a bit unique, and I'll talk about that a little bit in the next slide here. So I'll talk about CDFW's comment letter. CDFW expressed concern that pumping from the existing S wells and future S9 well could have significant impacts to the surrounding unarmored three-spine stickleback, or UTS, and groundwater-dependent ecosystems, GDEs. And that's due to the potential lowering of groundwater level and depletion of surface water in the Santa Clara River. They're also concerned that the project could divert surface water from the river if these wells are put back in service. And so our response, as we indicated in our letter to CDFW, is that the combined pumping from the S wells will not result in a significant impact for the following reasons. First, SEV water intends to pump these four wells in a manner that's consistent with historical pumping rates. Second, the pumping will not exceed quantities that were modeled in the groundwater sustainability plan that established groundwater trigger levels, which are in place to protect those GDEs. And third, we've included mitigation BIO3, which I mentioned, which states that the agency will monitor groundwater levels in the river in accordance with the GSP. If those groundwater trigger levels are reached, then the agency will evaluate to determine whether the pumping is the cause. If it is, then the agency would move forward what we call management actions, which basically could include a reduction in pumping or taking those wells offline to ensure that those GDEs are not impacted. And again, it's all in accordance with the adopted GSP and any future updates to the GSP. Next slide, please. All right, moving on to the final design consultant selection. Staff distributed requests for proposals for design services to 9 on-call engineering firms through Planet Bids. We received 3 proposals. The proposals were reviewed and scored by our internal selection committee based on project approach, project team, schedule, and firm qualifications. Hazen and Sawyer Inc. received the highest score, and staff recommends that they be awarded the project. Next slide. Okay, so Hazen and Sawyer's total engineering fee for design services is $1,425,505. This fee includes services from subconsultants such as surveyors, geotechnical engineers, structural engineers, and landscape architects that are needed for this somewhat complex project. We have $2 million allocated for design services in our fiscal year 23-24 CIP budget, which will cover Hazen's design cost. We're receiving a $5 million grant from the Bureau of Reclamation through their Water Smarts program, which staff is currently working on finalizing a funding agreement. And we're also actively pursuing other grant opportunities to help us fund this very, very important project. Next slide. On schedule, with your recommendation tonight and board's approval in June, we expect final design will start in sometime in July of this year and be completed by next summer of next year. And then we anticipate construction will start in late 2024. Construction will take approximately 18 months to complete, putting us at substantial completions in the summer of 2026. Next slide. So in conclusion, staff recommends that the Engineering and Operations Committee recommends that the Board of Directors approve adopting a resolution approving the S-Wells PFAS Groundwater Treatment and Disinfection Facilities Project Initial Study Mitigated Negative Declaration, Mitigation Monitoring and Reporting Plan, and authorize a purchase order to Hazen and Sawyer Consultants for an amount not to exceed $1,425,505 for final design services for the S-Wells PFAS Treatment and Disinfection Facility Project. With that, I thank you for your time, and I will hand it back to Chairman Cooper.
Thank you. Liz, are there any members of the public on the outside that wish to speak?
Seeing none.
Ms. Miltonmeyer, you have a comment on this one?
Did I put one in?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's very interesting what they're presenting and how much it's going to cost to get rid of PFAS. We're looking at $1,425,505. That's a lot of money. So you have a big decision to make. And if you approve this, just where are you getting the money? Those are your problems, not mine. I know what I would be doing. But this is something for the decision of those that are elected to do it. And you can tell us at that time where you're going to get the money.
Very good. Is that in your comment? I'm sorry.
That is my comment, but I will be following my directions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee members? Director Orzowski.
All right. Thank you for the presentation. If you go to page 9 of your presentation, page 41 of the board packet, I'm looking at section A, where that's where they're going to be located. With respect to, groundwater. Are we worried about, water accumulating in that space? Is there drainage, a pump? It's going to pump water out during, rainy days, or if one of the vessels, the vessel would be okay, but are we worried about water accumulation in that space, in that depressed space?
Yeah, Director Ozohowski, yeah, that's a really good point. There is a storm rain pipeline that's next to this facility, and so we will be installing catch basins within that depressed slab that would be capturing any runoff and then directing that to that storm rain pipe. So it would flow by gravity.
And then into the Santa Clara River?
Yes, that's correct. That there's an existing storm rain pipe that drains to the Santa Clara River today.
Thank you. Back to you, Chair.
President Martin.
Thank you, Chair Cooper. Orlando, thank you for the presentation. Very good. Number one, I appreciate the detail provided in the staff report, all the drawings, all the information, all the background. In your public outreach effort, I think you indicated in the report that you've acted on some of the suggestions and questions and concerns from the public. Do you believe we addressed all the issues that came up at the two meetings, or were there some that we could not do?
There was some that we had various comments from all spectrum, right, across the spectrum there. So, you know, we took all the comments and we created a table and we tried to incorporate as much as we can. Now, mind you, this is all preliminary design at this point, but we are going to consider each of those comments as we get into final design. There may not be a situation where we can accommodate every single comment. So for instance, somebody was saying, well, I don't want to see the treatment facility from up above. So, you know, we have to look at those things. Well, we'll be studying that as we get into final design.
Are there viewpoints from up above that someone would see that and be concerned about other than...
We don't think so.
Southwest Airlines flight coming into Burbank.
I don't think that's an issue. I mean, we looked at that, and the nearest building is over 400 feet away, and there's a bunch of trees out there, so it's not an issue.
Okay. Well, anyway, I think the staff for the effort that went out to address the public's concern, and looking at the rendering of the project, it just seems to me there's not a lot to be concerned with all the landscaping that's been put around, all the efforts been made to make it blend into the community. I appreciate that. And forgive me if I missed it in your presentation or staff report. I assume we've acquired the land to do this on, or have we not?
We will be getting a lease from the city. So we will be signing a lease agreement with the city, long-term lease.
Who is the underlying owner?
The city of Santa Clarita.
Okay. Very good. Okay. And thanks, Orlando.
We have met with them on several occasions. They understand the project. They were part of the initial looks at it and what we wanted to do. If you remember from a prior committee meeting, we actually were looking at doing some educational features that the city said they were not interested in doing because they didn't want to maintain that park. So we've been working in close conjunction with
them. I'm sure you have. Yes.
Orlando, my only question is why are we leasing rather than purchasing the property? I mean, it's not like our facility is going to go away.
Right. I think there's some legal hiccups with the property there because it's Courtney, I forget the term that they use, the city does, but we've had some several over a course of a year. We had discussions with the city, and our intent was to purchase the property, but they come back and said, no, we can only do a lease with them.
It would be the same issue of us trying to sell a piece of property that it's got to go on the open market.
Yes, that's correct. And I forget the term. I'm sorry.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Orlando.
Sure.
Any other questions? Director Peterson?
Orlando, I noticed that pipeline going towards Newhall Ranch Road in an easement. Who's the property owner for that?
That is also the city of Santa Clarita, but we do have an easement where that pipe is going to be located.
You have that easement already?
Yes.
That's right next to the MWD easement, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. That's all
right. Yeah. Yes. Any other questions? We'll move this forward then to the board. This is probably one that needs to be presented to the board. This is a significant amount of money that the board needs. We can do a short presentation on it, I would think. Hey, thank you, Orlando.
Thank you all. Have a wonderful night.
Hey, item six, Shoddy. Recommend approval pursuant to the addendum of MMD for the South End Recycled Water Main Extension. Shoddy.
All right, great. Thank you, Chair Cooper. Good evening, everybody. This is Shoddy Bader, Senior Engineer. This item in front of you today is to recommend approval to adopt two resolutions to apply for a grant under the State Water Resources Control Board's Water Recycling Funding Program. As always, agency staff look for grant opportunities to offset construction costs as much as possible. And usually when we apply for grants, a board action is required, is usually required as part of the application. So tonight you will see that you have two resolutions. One is the normal resolution we usually sign as part of this process. And the other one is a resolution that State Water Resources Control Board has requested that has certain languages. And this is for their own use, for their own internal use and process. So currently we are completing final design and securing all final permits for the for this project. And we anticipate bidding this project sometime around fall of 2023. So let's get right into it. Next slide, please. So here's a location map for the full project. This extension will tie into existing recycled water pipeline in the Old Road and Valencia Boulevard, and will extend recycled water to the agency's southern service area. As you can see, this is the largest project in the Recycled Water Phase 2 program. Next slide, please. So we're going to be dividing the Phase 2C project into two separate projects. The first one is the one you see here, which is, we called it Reach 1. And some facts about this Reach 1 is that it's going to connect, like we mentioned, at the Old Road and Valencia Boulevard. And we're going to construct about 13,000 feet of new recycled water main. And some of the potential users are going to be College of the Canyon, CalArts, Valencia Golf Course, Vistec Valencia Golf Course, and some HOA and median meters. The current construction cost is estimated around $12 million. And a few months ago, we secured a $3 million integrated regional water management, or IRWIM, construction grant for this project as well. Next slide, please. So this grant that we're applying for, some of the facts for that is there is a 50% matching fund requirement. We are applying for about $2.9 million in grant funding, or about 25% of the total construction cost. The preliminary application was submitted on April 13th of 2023, and the project must be completed by January 2025. This project will help meet the agency's strategic plan objective, B.1.1.4, which is to complete the final design of the South End Recycled Water Main Project, and strategic plan objective C.3.4, which is to pursue grant funding for recycled water projects. Next slide, please. So with that, staff recommends that the Engineering and Operations Committee recommends that the Board of Directors first adopt the two resolutions authorizing the General Manager to apply for grant funding under the State Water Resources Control Board's Water Recycling Funding Program for the South End Recycled Water Main Extension, the Phase 2C Reach 1 project, and second, to execute a grant agreement if the State Water Resource Control Board awards the grant, and third, to submit any required documents, invoices, and reports required to obtain grant funding for the South End Recycled Water Main Extension Phase 2C Reach 1 project. Please consider placing this item on the consent calendar if you see appropriate. And with that, I have completed my presentation. And now let me hand it over back to you, Chair Cooper.
Thank you, Shadi. Liz, are there any members of the public out there that wish to speak on this?
Seeing none.
Questions from the board? From the committee?
Thank you, Shadi. This project is a component of our recycled water program, and it's very expensive. And to have acquired the grant and to be applying for additional grant funds is going to help the agency's ratepayers to put this in the ground and get this phase of the project complete. And so we very much appreciate the efforts to get the grant. I'm fully supportive of moving this forward. This one probably could go to consent.
I would think so. Any other questions?
No, I agree. Consent.
Consent calendar. Look, all right. We'll move this forward to the board on the consent calendar. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Shadi. Hey, item 7. This is to execute a MMD for the Sierra Highway Bridge Widening Project between Santa Clarita and City of Santa Clarita. And Elizabeth Subject.
Good evening, Chairman Cooper. Sorry for a second, my camera doesn't want to set in the correct place. I'm sorry, I apologize.
We got you bouncing around there. That's
yes, because it doesn't want to stay in one place. All right. It has to be like that. Sorry. One more time. Good evening, Chairman Cooper and committee members. My name is Elizabeth Sobczak. I am associate engineer in SCV Water. Tonight, I would be presenting Sierra Highway Bridge Pipelines Protection and Installation Project to request authorization to execute agreement with the City of Santa Clarita for bidding and for the project construction. Next slide, please. Sierra Highway Bridge over Santa Clara River is located in the city of Santa Clarita. It is bounded on north by Soledad Canyon Road, on east by California State Route 14, on south by Via Princesa, and on west by White's Canyon Road. Sierra Highway, including bridge, is public right of way. City of Santa Clarita is in the process designing Sierra Highway Bridge Widening Project. The city's Sierra Highway Bridge Widening Project will modify, expand, and widen the northbound bridge deck and replace and widen entire southbound bridge. On this slide, we are showing in purple color new bridge areas to be constructed. Please note that on this picture, on the picture is showing the bridge, and north is on the right side of the slide. Next slide, please. Agency's three existing pipelines, 48-inch diameter Sand Canyon pipeline, our potable water transmission main, and two potable water distribution system pipelines are located in very close proximity to the bridge. The existing pipelines will need to be protected during the construction of the bridge project. Sierra Highway, including bridge, is public right of way. SCV Water is required paying for cost of implementing measures to protect our existing pipelines from bridge construction impacts. It is beneficial to SCV Water to include pipelines protection as part of the city bridge widening project and reimburse the city for construction cost of our pipelines protection work. 48-inch Sand Canyon pipelines is located in Santa Clara River Trail, very close to the bridge embankment. And 14-inch PVC pipeline and 18-inch steel pipelines are in the are located in Santa Clara riverbed. Existing pipelines are shown in the dark blue color on the slide. During design of the bridge widening project, an opportunity occurred for SCV Water to install new pipelines in new constructed bridge cells for new potable water and new recycled water main. Proposed potable water and recycled water pipelines are shown in the light green color on the slide. Next slide, please. Bridge widening construction work will involve modification to the bridge embankment where our 48-inch Sand Canyon pipelines is installed. Pile driving operation will be conducted and construction equipment will be operated in the riverbed near our two distribution system, 14-inch PVC and 18-inch steel pipelines. This slide is showing in the red color segments of our existing pipelines that are anticipated to be impacted by the bridge construction work and required to be protected. Next slide, please. To protect our existing pipelines, agency is in the process of designing improvements to mitigate negative impacts on the pipelines during the bridge widening construction work. concrete protection wall would be constructed between 48-inch San Canyon pipelines, and permission grouting would be injected around our pipeline to encapsulate our pipeline to protect it from vibration from construction work. Also, vibration monitoring station would be installed along the segments of San Canyon pipeline to observe, monitor, and to control vibration forces during the bridge construction. Next slide, please. SCV water design will also include installation of new potable water and recycled water pipelines inside new constructed bridge cells. New 20-inch diameter potable water pipeline, which is shown on the slide as dashed green line, will be connected as a part of the pipeline's protection and installation project to the existing potable water system, is shown on the slide in dark blue color. New 20-inch diameter recycled water pipeline is shown as the red dashed line. Next slide, please. 20-inch recycled water pipeline is planned for a future recycled water system extension. New recycled water pipeline will be installed with both ends capped. On this slide are shown two new southbound bridge cells that are reserved for our new water mains. Next slide, please. Generally, the construction contract documents are being prepared by the agency to protect existing and to install new pipelines. In accordance with agreement, drawings and technical specification will be prepared by SCV Water and will be incorporated within the city Sierra Highway Bridge Widening Project bid package. SCV Water construction work will be included under separate bid items in the bid schedule of Sierra Highway Bridge Widening Project. The city will advertise the project for construction bid. The city will evaluate the bids and will provide the bid of the lowest responsive and responsible bidder to SCV Water for review and approval prior to awarding the construction contract. After receiving bid from the city, we will come back to the engineering and operation committee and to the board for approval of construction cost of SCV Water pipelines protection and installation project. Next slide, please. City will administer, manage, and coordinate construction of the project. Any change order request would be related to SCV Water pipelines protection or installation construction work will be submitted by the city to SCV Water for review and approval before the work will be approved by the city and construction work could commence. The city will be invoicing the agency for cost of construction of pipelines protection and pipelines installation work on monthly basis, an agency will review the billings and reimburse the construction cost to the city. Next slide, please. Schedule of the Sierra Highway Bridge project is fast track type of the schedule. The city of Santa Clarita signed agreement at end of March 2023. Finalizing of construction documents is scheduled in November this year. Advertising for construction bids by the city is planned in December this year. And the city is expecting open the bid in February and start construction in May 2024. Construction of bridge widening project is anticipated to be completed in about 2.5 years from now in August 2023. Estimated construction cost of SCV water pipelines protection and installation work is about $4 million. Project cost is included in fiscal 23-24 budget. At present, we are not asking for construction cost approval. After we will receive bid from the city, we will evaluate the bid and present the bid and ask engineering and operation committee and board of directors for construction cost approval. That would be in the future. At this time, we are only requesting approving adoption of mitigation negative declaration and execution of the approval of execution of the agreement. Next slide, please. Staff recommends that engineering and operation committee recommends that board of directors adopt a resolution authorizing general manager to execute an agreement on behalf of SCV Water with City of Santa Clarita for Sierra Highway Bridge Pipelines Protection and Installation Project. This is concluding my presentation. Thank you for the opportunity to present this project. And I would like to ask to place this agenda item on consent if it would be appropriate. Back to you, Chairman Cooper.
Very good. Thank you, Elizabeth. Any questions from outside?
None from outside.
And we have one from Ms. Moldenmeyer. Mm-hmm.
This is, we have to get into what you're discussing. There is an agreement to somehow let the city do all the negotiations on this. That's the way it seems to be written, as the city has proposed construction and all the way through it, and you seem to have agreed to that. Read it. That's what it's saying. So, where is the protection for the ratepayers, the water agency, when you get in there making agreements with, what is it? The Santa Clara River. To me, this one just doesn't make sense in what you're doing. I don't know if you think you're saving money or what is your problem with doing that? Water agency owns and maintains 48-inch diameter. I can see your pipes are down there where they're considering expanding the freeways. Isn't that what's going on? That's what I'm reading here. And through the whole thing, suddenly you give up and just say, well, let them do what they want. We'll just make sure they're doing what we want. But I don't see any guarantees in here for the ratepayers of the water company. Can you point to it in here? Did you read it? Can you point to what I'm discussing?
Is that the end of your comments?
Yes, if you can answer it.
Okay, thank you. Please.
Yeah, this project is what we term an external agency mandate. This case, the city of Santa Clarita is widening a bridge that impacts our pipelines, and therefore we are obligated to protect our pipelines to the benefit of our ratepayers and ensure that those ratepayers our facilities are protected. We also are looking to take advantage of the fact that the bridge is being built and add some pipelines and interconnections into the bridge deck at this time, because it would be significantly more expensive to come back in there if we didn't have that reservation in those bays, didn't have that steel line in there. We are in that road It is a public road, and therefore the city has superior rights to our pipeline. And if they choose to redo their facilities, we are obligated to do that at our cost. Similarly, Edison is required to redo their electrical, which also runs through that, and will also have a bay within that bridge. And they will be paying for all of their own relocations and protections on that bridge as well.
Very good. It's very common.
It is. But I wanted to be thorough in this.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Stone.
We'll wait for the directors, but I do have a question.
Please.
I noticed the 16-inch PVC pipeline.
14,
yes. The favorite size.
Yes, as
what's the prognosis on that pipeline?
As Mike informed me, because I asked him the same thing, that is DR18. So it is a thicker PVC and not one we've been having an issue with. So we will be looking to protect it in place and not replace it.
And the cover on it is good with the river there?
I don't know the depth of cover on that particular pipe. Unfortunately, we have several pipelines that are in the river.
Was it contributed?
Was the...
Really? Just checking.
Yeah. I do know that as part of this, what we're looking to do for the protection, I believe it may have been in the report, is they're looking to concrete encase some of those sections of pipe to prevent them from having issues with the pile driving or the vibration that may be happening for the bridge piers. So that would be also covered.
Thank you. I just figured you had thought through it, and I thought it would be interesting to share that. So I appreciate that.
But since you're replacing, you're putting the 20-inch through the bridge, would you put ductile from there over to the PVC, that section, since you're relocating that as well?
Yes. Yes.
That's okay.
But sorry for jumping the line.
No, it's good. You're always the head of the questions from the committee.
President, I think thank you, Chair Cooper. Elizabeth, and the 14-inch PVC gets everyone's attention. Anytime that shows up on a plan, especially something that we're about to do in construction, but is the detail for protection similar to what we're doing for the 48-inch? Because there was no detail in the presentation for how we're going to protect that 14-inch.
That's correct. Because we still didn't get the permit for potholing the existing 14-inch and 18-inch pipeline, we are not able to determine what would be the distance from the vibration source. We are in the process of obtaining those permits. Unfortunately, the river area is under jurisdiction of many big governmental agencies, and it's for now taking over a year to obtain the permit to pothole those two existing distribution system pipelines in the river. So we didn't start design yet for those two distribution pipelines. However, the design for the Sand Canyon pipelines is near to be completed. So even if this is one project, but unfortunately, there is two different statuses of design for the protection of the pipelines. So that's why we have the information, and we provided information what is designed for the Sand Canyon pipelines, but for those two smaller pipe, because we never have the record drawings and we really don't know exactly where they are located, we need to pothole. And it's taking very long time to obtain the permits to be able to do potholing work.
It is assumed that we will be using very similar protection methods.
Second, one more comment. Mr. Mayo beat me to the punch, but I had written in my notes already that protection of ratepayers includes also protection of important and valuable assets of the agency which belong to the ratepayers. It's not just protecting the ratepayers against cost, is protecting the assets of the agency against projects like this. And that actually bridges over to the first public comment that was questioned or criticized for working with the city on this project. There's no other way to do this. This is the city's bridge project. And we're fortunate to be able to add some lines through the south of that bridge at a reduced cost. Of the agency doing it on its own would be much more expensive. I'm very supportive of the project, and you can try it on consent.
Director Orzovsky?
Good question. Why are they widening this bridge?
Because it's a very old bridge. It doesn't meet right now all the standards. So it has to be upgraded to the new highway standards. So LA County beginning this process over 10 years ago. And now the city continue with this project to redesign the bridge. That's why the half of the bridge would be the new bridge.
Understood. And Ms. Sobchak, curious. And let me preface with an adjective. Who came up with a good idea of utilizing the two cells for future use? You know, recycled water and potable water pipeline in that bridge. That's something that... what's the process? It's a good idea. It's great. How did that come about?
That city during one of our meetings with all utilities involved, because there is a lot of utilities involved in this project. There is a gas company, the Edison has the huge, and also all those communication companies have a lot of utilities in this area. So during these meetings, the city announced that because there would be half of the new bridge, all the bridge cells would be new, upgraded. There is opportunity. This is only one opportunity for utilities utilize any cell for the our facilities, because later, it would be almost impossible to add anything because it would require redesign the bridge again.
I understand that. I just want to know, we're being presented this from the city just because, you know, it's interfering. I mean, it's affecting our pipelines. But how did we decide to put in these two pipelines that we may use in the future?
Yeah, and I think I can answer that. Elizabeth. So we do an evaluation when we're given an opportunity like this, when we're giving a external agency mandate, we review over the best opportunities we have. They have cells available. They let us know that those could be utilized by utilities. Some of those are going to be taken up by gas or electrical, and these have two bays. We don't currently have a recycled water program in that area. I don't know that we will implement the recycled water pipeline in that area. It could be that we utilize it for two potable water. But we do look at that through hydraulic modeling and system analysis to determine the size best used to go through that bridge deck and what's available within the bridge decks. Usually you are limited on the amount of space you have. So the city presents us with the opportunity. They let us know that the cells are available. We would have requested them anyway, as we are doing with one of the five-point bridges. We will have cells available in that. But we will, the sizing comes from internal evaluation, working with operations and our internal model.
Okay. And then last question, inspection, that will be done by us. We won't be outsourcing that.
That's correct. As for now, what we're planning during the construction, we will provide the inspection by our own staff.
And just to be crystal clear on that, we probably will be outsourcing it to our own consultant that we pay for. Our internal staff will probably not have the time to sit on the bridge and do the inspection, but we will hire a consultant who does inspection for us and is monitored by our inspection team. Similar to we do with other projects, other CIP projects, where we have a consultant inspector on site that is paid for and managed by our staff.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Director Peterson.
Cardinal, you brought up a subject that with the PVC recycled water pipeline possibility. no, and maybe not a possibility. There is other ways of accomplishing pipes and bridges, like putting a sleeve in versus putting the actual pipe in. Has that been considered?
It has been considered for this project. You don't have a ton of room. So if you were putting in a 20-inch sleeve, typically you need a 4-inch surrounding spacer. So now all of a sudden you're down to only a 12-inch pipe. We need potentially more service room than that. That being said, if we did put in a 20-inch steel pipe, it would work pretty efficiently as a casing if we only needed a 12-inch recycled water main. So regardless, the 20-inch steel casing that we are steel pipe would work for either way. Either we could utilize it as the actual carrier pipe, or we would do a casing and put a smaller carrier through it.
And just another follow-up to that is, are we designing the system inside or outside? Who's the design engineer for this?
Lien Roth.
Yeah.
And Lien Roth hire Dokken, which is the city bridge consultant. So the same consultant who is designing the bridge for the city is sub-consultant to Lien Roth to evaluate and make sure that everything is meeting the standards and everything is working correctly.
Yeah, what's that?
Jen?
Okay. Sir Billing, the bridge widening parcel is different than the original. One figure, one box.
Yeah.
I noticed that too. Most likely the old one was built as by Caltrans too.
Yeah.
Oh, Caltrans.
Hey. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate.
Okay. Hey, item 8, Mr. Elmer.
Thank you very much, Chair Cooper. We're still here. The monthly operations and production report is in your packet. If you have any specific questions, I'd be more than happy to answer. I would like you to note that the 33 inches of rain plus whatever we got today, it's a lot, but in 04-05, we had over 50, and I think in 97-98, we also had over 50. So it's not the most in the recent years, at least since I've been working in this valley.
I remember.
But it's a lot.
Today was a little over, just a hair over a half an inch at my place.
Okay. All right. So we might hit 34, 35.
Yeah.
It was still great. It was good.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Any questions for Mr. Albert from the outside?
Seeing none.
Okay.
So in 04-05, we had 52. Were there major flooding events in exactly?
I don't recall. I mean, there were, but it was pretty similar to this. This just seemed more intense. If I'm not
relatively,
yeah,
just went through a drought.
Yeah, so I mean, that could be part of it. I know there were some issues with some of the pipelines being exposed in the river back then, which we didn't have that issue this year. Yeah, so you know, it's. I think that might also have been the year that our sewer got hit by some boulders. At least one of
That was 97.
That was 97, 98. Okay. I knew it was one of the big ones.
Yeah, I think we scoured pipeline up by pitches up in that area.
Yes. The one that crosses, yeah, the Cascade Creek. Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. But yeah, this year we did not have any pipeline issues that are in the river.
What I remember about 2004-05 is that there seemed to be a rainstorm every Friday. Flooded out everything.
Back to you, Chair.
Hey, any other question for Mike? Item 9, Mr. Mayo, Kaplan CIP Projects.
The CIP projects are contained in your packet, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Questions outside folks?
No public comment.
Questions in a minute? There's a lot of stuff coming up in our folder. The type just gets smaller and smaller.
We can make the type bigger if you want more pages.
No, it's all right. Okay, item 10, Mr. Mayo, third-party funding agreements.
These are the developer agreements, and we do this quarterly. So this is the list of our development projects. If you have any questions on them, I'd be happy to entertain those questions.
Can you just quickly go over them? And not all of them, but just... it's the In-N-Out Burger, this third-party funding source.
Yeah, so In-N-Out Burger, they built a new facility over there near Magic Mountain. They had to do a installed fire service and water service to that, specifically to that restaurant. And they did that work and had to pay for inspection. And so we take deposits on that, wait for the work to be completed, which it should be nearly completed. I think they may have a punch list item left out there. And then we close that out and turn the funds. So the contributed asset from them would be a fire service and water service. They may have had a fire hydrant requirement as well, depending on how many fire hydrants were around the facility. I can't remember.
Thank you. Back to you, Chair.
Any other questions?
That's the Dean Cooper. Public comment.
The Dean Cooper. Yes. Oh my God.
Chair Cooper. Yeah. Public comments.
Oh, excuse me. Public comments. Anybody?
Seeing none.
Okay, no other comments. We'll move on to item 11, Mr. Mayo, committee planning calendar.
So we have this calendar in here. I know that we've been following this format. I'm open to suggestions if you guys had wanted to look at different formats. I know we do this for each committee, so it would be potentially wider range. I think we do a pretty good job of tracking where these are all at, but I do notice by the end of the year, you're flipping through a lot of pages just to get to the month you're at. So one of the options we could do is start to eliminate prior months. Maybe we only go back 3 months and we look forward 3 months, and that you keep this calendar a little more narrow in scope, if that's okay. That would be something I would like to consider on this item.
Okay. We could try that, see how it
goes. Yeah, works. I mean, I generally just look ahead.
Yeah.
You want just 1 month behind or?
Month behind, you don't much care about. 1 month behind would be fine.
Okay. And then whatever distance we have going.
Yes. Sure.
Yeah. Is that okay, or am I going to get in trouble for me?
It should be fine. I will. And then we did increase the font size again on this one. So I think this will be the largest we can go, but if we're scaling it down, it should be okay. And then there's also a preview. There's next year's preview in there.
Yeah, it is better.
Okay, good. Sometimes it's hard because I have it on the screen, so it's blown up very large for me. So,
hey, Mr. Albert.
So I had
operations. Before we go there, do you want public comment on that? And then for the...
Didn't we?
No. That was on the last time.
Seeing none.
Thank you.
I had a few things, but since we are going long, it's up to you. It's whatever the pleasure of the committee is. We can push this to Keith in June, or I can do my few things in a few minutes.
Let's do your few things in a few minutes.
I want to acknowledge, and I feel terrible that we didn't during our last fall staff meeting, Mike Steeves, retired last Friday, 35 years. Yeah. Wow. He was our utility operations lead. He is one of the field guys that I hold in the highest regard in the entire agency. His work ethic, the way he treats staff. I never had anybody come to me saying anything about him negative. He was a fantastic guy. I hated to see him go, but I really am happy for him. So I just wanted to mention that.
Don't want any questions. Who let that happen?
Yeah, I know. It was sad. Some of the guys actually got a little choked up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it shows you how much they cared for him.
Yeah. I'm sure he had a great deal of knowledge about
it. Oh my gosh, yeah. So we have his personal number. So yeah. If we ever have a question, we'll get back to him. Are you going to pull up the presentation? There's a couple items and that we're going to skip through the committee and go straight to the board on the 16th. I'll explain the reason why for those. But one of them has to do with groundwater well maintenance. And I thought it would be appropriate to show you what exactly our staff does and what they can't do in terms of groundwater well maintenance. Next slide, please. So
We have 36, and I put in quotes, active domestic wells, right? Some of them are offline because of PFAS, but they're still classified as active in our permit. We have 9 active Saugus wells, and I put the depth because that's really specific related to what our staff can and can't do. So the alluvial wells are quite shallow, 116 to 310 feet, with the Saugus wells going all the way down to 2130 feet deep. We also have 8 what we call inactive standby and non-potable well, right? So we have a well that serves the golf course at Vista Valencia, well 159. We also have the old Lombardi well, which is on the property right next to our guard shack. Those would be classified as non-potable or inactive or standby and such. And I gave the picture because everything above ground, with the exception of like we have to rewind a motor, our staff maintains, can remove, can replace, can do all of that work. So all the air and vacuum valves, the check valves, the control pump control valves, the piping, all of that sort of work our staff handles. And then below ground, there's some work that we can do, but generally we have to go out to a contractor. Next slide. So the routine above ground maintenance, I broke it down into 4 things: reading, listening, sampling, and physical, right? So we take flow rate reads, we take production reads, daily production reads, we take pressures, disinfection dosages. All of this is in SCADA as well. We do a lot of listening. And I guess I could have put feeling because there are temperature variances that can happen. And staff is trained and understands how to do that. But they listen for vibrations in motors and pumps. We take sampling to make sure the water quality, as Jeff mentioned, we're in compliance with everything. And then they can adjust and replace mechanical equipment. The picture on the top is one of our wells. I think that's N8 that actually is part of the NWELS PFAS treatment. And below that is just a picture of a disinfection facility. So our staff actually rebuilt this equipment. Now, obviously, they don't build the rectifiers and all the equipment, but they set all this stuff up. They did all that work that you're seeing in that lower picture. They attached it to the wall. And we either had it today or having it next Thursday, our DDW inspection to get the new disinfection facility permitted. And this is a rebuild of an existing one. Yeah. Next slide. This is really what I want you to see because we do some below ground maintenance. Our staff is capable of pulling the pump and motor of all of our alluvial wells because they only go down to 310 feet. We do not have the equipment, the crane, to remove the pump from the Saugus pump. So we have to hire a contractor for that. But if you can play the video, Liz, this should be a video. One of the guys took this. You'll notice they all have their safety equipment on. And that you can't see it on the other side of the fence is what they're laying it on a flatbed. I mean, these guys, they don't work that fast. But it is impressive of how much work we actually do in-house. And, you know, it adds to their ownership of it. And it makes them feel proud that they're able to work on behalf of the residents of the valley to make sure our facilities are reliable, operate well, and the water quality is going to be great. The only other thing I wanted to mention was, as Jeff mentioned, we're capable of the lab capacity. I sat in on a PFAS presentation by AWWA this week, and EPA is expecting over 280,000 PFAS samples a year in this country. And our lab only takes up a small portion of that. But he has the capacity to handle all of our samples, which saves the ratepayers a considerable amount considering how much pressure is on the commercial labs for running those samples. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is I'm pushing hard with our staff on getting the consolidated public water system permit. So we have a single permit. Yeah. I got Ryan By and his staff and a couple other folks that are involved. We have a quarterly meeting on May 30th this month and we're going to spend a good portion of it talking with DDW about getting this done. So
what is their objection to that? I don't understand why there should be.
They're not now. The initial objection is, what's that?
Diplomacy.
Yeah, so they have issues with their staff, right? They're going through staffing changes, right? They had retirements. They had two big retirements this last year. And so they were concerned about that. When we merged, everybody had a total coliform rule plan, right? Sampling plan. We all had a disinfection byproduct sampling plan, et cetera, et cetera. And we had to merge those all together into one. So it's consistent. The language is consistent. We still have to have separate plans, but the language is consistent. And so we have those separate plans. Now we've been able to merge it all into one. We're not using it yet, but we will. So that was one of their concerns. If there was going to be any differences in water sampling criteria, if they want to make sure that our system is hydraulically interconnected, and it is. And so when we had our meeting in January, I don't know if you're familiar with Kurt Souza, but he's actually the assistant deputy director of DDW now. He's our region chief. So he oversees, Santa Barbara. He's in Carpinteria, Los Angeles, San Diego. He's the chief over that. When we talked about it, because we've been mentioning it in every single quarterly meeting with DDW, when I mentioned at the end, he bit. And he says, why can't we get this done? And so we discussed it. He says, let me chat with my staff offline. Within a week, he sent me an email and says, we're going to help you make this happen. So, yeah. So I'm optimistic that it's going to be done before the end of the year, but I'll say by the end of the year, because that way, if it comes before, at least it looks better. And that's all I wanted to share. So thank you for...
Yeah, that's great. That's great progress.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Any questions from outside, Liz?
Seeing none.
From the committee? Thank you. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate that one. And Mr. Mayo, general report on engineering services.
Yeah, I have a little presentation that I'm really going to go through pretty quickly, just in the interest of time. But one of the slides, at least, is directly relevant to what Director Ozahowski was talking about. So we'll go over that. A lot of these are the same projects that you see. We don't have a lot of new projects coming in. In the larger scale, these take many years to develop, but so they've been on the list for a while. Next slide, please. So just kind of flipping through the, or are these not slides, the PDF, okay. just kind of flipping through, these are the development areas we've been working on, you know, about Mission Village and Tesoro, the projects we've been working on through those areas. Next slide. So again, down into the southeast, you have MetroWalk. If you've driven down in that area, they are doing some large amount of grading, and that's the project that we just recently dealt with, the easement issue, and so that is being resolved. Next, scroll down. And then again, over here on the southwest side, a few other projects there. Last slide, and last one I wanted to go, this involves all the little projects that are also coming in. These are the ones that do change on a very regular basis, either under construction or during plan check. Some are construction complete, and we're nearing notice of completion. What I noticed on here is we didn't include in and out, which means we closed it out. So it showed up on my on the quarterly developer list, but I do believe we've been making a pretty active effort on the last few months to close out any remaining projects, trying to clear them out before we have a new fiscal year audit. So we want to make sure we're doing that efficiently as possible. So this is a more up-to-date list of projects that we're actively working on, small scale. Highlight one that I'm interested in. There's a little Tesla dealership coming in the middle of town. So some people are interested in that. Other than that, there's a lot of very small projects. There's a couple Chick-fil-A's. In case you're interested, maybe we should highlight the food places when we come through here. But
this is the Pace Street.
Wait, which side is Chick-fil-A on? It's got to be on.
There's the two. There's one over by Magic Mountain Parkway, and then there's another one in the middle of Pace Street near the Valley Center Wells over here off Soledad, over by the bowling alley.
What are you doing on Pace Street? That's right down there in the bottom right-hand corner.
I don't know. I can ask and get back with you with our development staff. But as
just curious, because one of our former directors lived right there, and it's only two houses long. So
I will look into it. I'll let you know. The construction is complete, so it's pending the notice of completion. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a new service installation for a new home over there.
Oh, new home.
Yeah.
So and there's three houses on the street.
Yeah, there might be three. And that's what I have for you today.
All right. Very good. That's it. A lot of work coming up.
That's
a lot of work going on.
I try to keep it the development side or CIP side. If I show it all at once, you guys get worried.
Any questions out there, Liz?
Seeing none.
Very good. Anything from the committee?
What's happening at Skestic Library?
They are doing an expansion, so they need a new fire system, I do believe.
So that's an upsize and a meter then, probably.
I don't know if they have to upsize their meter, but they have to put in a fire protection system. I do believe it was fire service, but I'd have to verify that. These I don't know as well as the CIP projects or the larger development projects.
Blooms don't like water.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, I thank you all. Very good meeting. A lot of good information tonight. Thank you.
Nice.
Thank you.
Coming out.
Yeah, well, I had a meeting in the Mr. Garcia's water person.